is a sign of weakness. What grew out of this way of living was even more faulty thinking. If I'm not feeling brave or generous enough, I'm not helping enough. The key learnings from this rumble totally challenged the system. The first key learning, when you judge yourself for needing help, you judge those you are helping. When you attach value to giving help, you attach value to needing help. The second key learning, the danger of tying your self-worth to being a helper is feeling shame when you have to ask for help. And the last key learning, offering help is courageous and compassionate, but so is asking for help. The revolution. May you always do for others and let others do for you. Bob Dylan. I love this lyric from Dylan. It's such a beautiful wish because so many of us are good at giving help, but not at receiving it. Giving help can occasionally feel vulnerable. Asking for help always means risking vulnerability. This is critical to understand because we can't make it through the Rising Strong process without help and support. We all will need people we can turn to for help when we are rumbling with the more confusing parts of our stories. I turn to the people I trust the most, like Steve, my sisters, and my mother, for insight into the process. I've also leaned heavily on my therapist, Diana. In my work with the Daring Way leadership groups, we talk about what it means to trust people. We ask leaders to identify two or three specific behaviors that allow them to trust others. Two of the top answers that always emerge are, I trust people who will ask for help or support, and if someone asks me for help, I'm more likely to trust them because they're willing to be vulnerable and honest with me. This exercise gets interesting when leaders, in turn, talk about how reluctant they are to ask for help and support. How many times do we implore the people who work for us to ask for help when they need it? But experience shows that simply asking them to do this probably won't correlate strongly with how often they actually ask for help. We found a better correlation between the number of times we modeled what asking for help looks like and how comfortable folks are with asking for help. Both giving and receiving help must be part of the culture, and we as leaders need to model both if we are committed to innovation and growth. In The Gifts of Imperfection, I define connection as the energy that exists between people when they feel seen, heard, and valued, when they can give and receive without judgment, and when they derive sustenance and strength from the relationship. Connection doesn't exist without giving and receiving. We need to give and we need to need. This is true at work and at home. In a culture of scarcity and perfectionism, asking for help can be shaming if we're not raised to understand how seeking help is human and foundational to connection. We can encourage our children to ask for help. However, if they don't see us reaching out for support and modeling that behavior, they will instead attach value to never needing help. We also send strong messages to the people around us, including our children, friends, and employees, when they ask for help, and in return, we treat them differently, as if they are now less reliable, competent, or productive. The bottom line is that we need each other, and not just a civilized, proper, convenient kind of need. Not one of us gets through this life without expressing desperate, messy, and uncivilized need. The kind we are reminded of when we come face to face with someone who is in deep struggle. Dependence starts when we're born and lasts until we die. We accept our dependence as babies, and ultimately, with varying levels of resistance, we accept help as we get to the end of our lives. But in the middle of our lives, we mistakenly fall prey to the myth that successful people are those who help rather than need. and broken people need rather than help. Given enough resources, we can even pay for help and create the mirage that we are completely self-sufficient. But the truth is that no amount of money, influence, resources, or determination will change our physical, emotional, and spiritual dependence on others. Not at the beginning of our lives, not in the messy middle, and not at the end. For most of us, being an easy mark has come to mean being a chump or a sucker or a pushover, shaming identities that are associated with weakness and a lack of street smarts. For the strangers who broke bread at my grandmother's house, the mark was a sign of courage and compassion. For my grandmother, generosity and giving were not the opposite of receiving. They were parts of the compact between human beings. Regret is a tough but fair teacher. To live without regret is to believe you have nothing to learn, no amends to make, and no opportunity to be braver with your life. Chapter 9, Composting Failure. Rumbling with fear, shame, perfectionism, blame, accountability, trust, failure, and regret. Andrew is known around his office as a listener, a thinker, an expert in strategy, and the keeper of culture. He's the guy who doesn't say much, but when he does, everyone listens. His point of view is sought by colleagues throughout the successful advertising agency where he's worked for 12 years, especially when it comes to estimating costs and putting together bids for pitches. One colleague said, "Andrew is the reason it all works. His word is gold, and everyone trusts him." Andrew is part of a small group of senior leaders that I met with to discuss early versions of the Rising Strong process. After we met, Andrew, like Claudia, reached out to me to share what he had described as a painful failure at work. I'm grateful that he allowed me to interview him and two of his colleagues about his experience. I recognize so much of myself in this story, and I think you might too. In most advertising agencies, teams respond to proposals from potential clients by creating pitches that include their creative concepts and the estimated cost of executing them. This is notoriously stressful work, with fierce competition among ad agencies for clients and frequent tension between a company's creative and business teams. The creatives strive to wow the clients, while the business team has to make sure the project nets a profit. One of Andrew's primary responsibilities is overseeing the financial estimates and approving the final budget that accompanies every bid, basically telling the prospective client, "We can do it for this much money." Because Andrew has always framed the tension between art and money as necessary and valuable to the process, he is highly respected and liked by both sides of the organization. A colleague from the creative side said, "If Andrew tells me that we need to bring down expenses to make it work, I know he's thought about it, and I know he understands what he's asking me to do. I do it." One of Andrew's direct reports said, "I'm learning from him, and I trust him 100%. He's one of the most thorough people I know, and he's a straight shooter." The trust and influence that Andrew has earned over the years have also positioned him as the unofficial watchdog of the company culture. He accepted that there would naturally be tension between colleagues from time to time, but he had little tolerance for gossip, favoritism, and back-channel negotiations. Even in heated arguments, which there were plenty of, he was always upfront, respectful, and appreciative. This set the tone for the entire agency. When I asked Andrew how he got so good at his job, he said, "There's certainly a skill set when it comes to interpreting the creative piece and the management piece in terms of time and materials. But the real key is knowing yourself. You have to know where the quicksand is. Everyone has their own sinkholes." When I asked Andrew for examples of sinkholes, He gave me what he thought were the five most common ones. Number one, emotional blinders. I'm so emotionally invested in working with this client that I'm blind to the fact that our bid is too low for the scope of work. Number two, the loss leader. I'm convinced that a big discount on this project, even if we lose money, will lead to future work that will be more profitable and eventually offset this loss. Number three, uncharted territory. I'm going after this business in a category I have no experience in. I don't know what I don't know. Number four, win at any cost. I'm addicted to the thrill of the win, or another variation, my self-worth is tied to how much business I bring in. And number five, defensive pricing. I have to protect my turf with an existing client by making it difficult for a competitor to match my price, even if we take a loss. As I wrote these down, I couldn't help but notice their application to everyday life. I told Andrew that I'd never in my life put together a bid, but I'd spent plenty of time in similar sinkholes, like getting sucked in emotionally, living in the future, thinking in the short term, wanting to win, and being defensive. We laughed for a bit before Andrew got more serious and said, "But sometimes the greatest threat is keeping your head down and staying so focused on dodging the sinkholes that you lose sight of where you're going and why." This is his story. Everyone at Andrew's agency was ecstatic when they were asked to pitch a huge ad campaign for a well-known and influential brand. The proposal was especially exciting because the brand's needs intersected very well with the agency's strengths. The creative team was grateful for the big budget opportunity to showcase their work and hoped to add the high-profile company to their individual portfolios. The business team saw the tremendous revenue potential in this new strategic partnership. Within hours, the atmosphere in the office was electric. People were calling home to let their families know they'd be spending long hours in the office over the next 2 weeks. This pitch would require all hands on deck. Andrew wasn't quite as excited as the rest of the team. Everyone was already stretched thin. They had just the right number of projects in various places on the design and production timeline. Adding another, especially one of this size, could tip the balance. He also had mixed feelings about the client, who had a reputation in the industry for treating partners poorly. One of his good friends, a colleague who worked in a related field, had once described the client as a bully. Andrew was mulling over these concerns when Manuel, a senior member of the creative team, showed up in his office. "We've got this," Manuel said. "People are psyched about the project, and we can do it." His enthusiasm was contagious, and Andrew didn't want his doubts to squelch the team's passion, so he jumped in. Andrew said, "I know, we can do this." Andrew was generally measured in his responses, but he also liked a challenge and wasn't immune from the growing energy. For the next couple of weeks, Andrew worked long hours with the team to develop their pitch for the first round of selection. Managing internal relationships and building team cohesion during that period felt like a full-time job. When people are stretched, their coping skills start to fray. A mere 24 hours after Andrew spoke the words, "We can do this," the account manager and the creative director stood in front of him, having it out with each other. Despite the fatigue and tough group dynamics, the entire agency came together to celebrate when they found out they had made it to the second round of the selection process. The win felt like a balm for the frazzled, emotionally and physically exhausted team. But Andrew was still worried about the burden the heavy workload was placing on everyone, and he continued to have some nagging concerns about the client's reputation. Still, he was invested now, so he pushed down his uneasiness and joined in the celebration. The second round of the process required Andrew and the pitch team to fly to the Midwest for a face-to-face meeting with the company's branding team. In Andrew's words, this is where things went south. Andrew explained, "For almost an hour, I watched our team put heart and soul into explaining our ideas and concepts. He said, meanwhile, the entire branding team sat there, typing away on their laptops, rarely, if ever, looking up. We're used to some degree of inattention during these meetings, but it was obvious that these side conversations weren't even related to our pitch. Two people on the branding team then asked questions that had been addressed in the presentation, confirming that they had been too busy emailing or doing whatever it was on their laptops to even pay attention. After a third member of the branding team made an inappropriate and disrespectful comment to the presenter, Andrew told me, I did nothing. He looked at me. Within minutes of that meeting ending, I thought to myself, I am a screw-up. I am a failure. I let them down, and they will no longer trust me. It was absolutely a face-down moment for me. My team had worked 60-plus hours a week for 2 months, only to be completely dismissed by a group of people I had known in advance had the capacity and propensity to do that. Why hadn't I done something to prevent this? How would they ever trust me again? Nobody talked much on the car ride to the airport or on the plane ride home. The team members were deflated and angry and absolutely exhausted. The long hours had taken a toll on their health and their relationships, both inside and outside of work. Andrew said, the only thought in my head during the entire trip back was, I'm a screw-up. I didn't protect my people. I didn't do my job. I'm a screw-up. I failed. I've lost their trust. The tape was on a constant loop in my head. Andrew explained, when I woke up the next morning, my first thought was, I'm a failure and a screw-up. My second thought was, I need to get out of this. I need to make this work. I need an easy fix. Who else is to blame? Who else was responsible for this mess? Then it hit me. I'm hustling. Not only that, I'm underneath a rock. I need to get out from underneath this rock first. I cannot make any good decisions from under here. I thought of your work and realized, shit. I know this rock is shame. I called a friend who is also familiar with your work and told him the story. I told him that I couldn't get past the voice saying, I'm a screw-up. I couldn't get past how much I let everyone down, including myself. I couldn't get past losing their trust. Andrew told me that making that call to his friend was incredibly difficult, but the Rising Strong talk was still fresh in his mind, and he realized he was in it. He added wryly, I was willing to give it a shot. Desperate times call for desperate measures. His friend's reply was, I get it, and I think you might have screwed up, but you make 100 judgment calls every day. Do you think you're going to be able to make the right call every time? Does making a bad call make you a failure? He went on to ask Andrew what he would say to someone who worked for him if she had made a similar mistake. Andrew replied automatically, well, that's different. Making mistakes is part of the process. After hearing himself say that, Andrew sighed. Ah, no mistakes allowed, he said to his friend. This is my perfectionism talking, isn't it? Maybe so, his friend replied. That's probably why you called me. This is my stuff, too. Andrew described the feeling that came over him during that conversation as relief. It was so helpful to recognize that rock as shame and to make the choice to get out from underneath it. It doesn't mean that what's ahead is going to be easy, but it does mean that I can stop hustling. I can start making decisions that are in line with my values. At this point in my career, I need to know how to own my mistakes and set things right. When Andrew got to work that day, he was greeted by a team that was still emotionally spent, but also completely confused. Despite their reading of the pitch meeting as a disaster, it turned out that they, along with one other agency, had made it to the final round. No one knew how to react. That's when Andrew called a meeting to decide their next move. I have to tell you, he said, addressing the team. When we decided to take on this project, I was so focused on proving that we could do this that I forgot to ask the most important question. Should we do it? We were stretched to the max before we started, and I knew this client was potentially a bad fit for us. It was my job to step back and ask questions, and I didn't. I screwed up. I made a mistake, and I apologize. I hope I can regain your trust. The room was quiet until Manuel finally responded. Thank you for saying that. I do trust you. What happens next? Andrew told them that given the time everyone had put in, and the money and resources invested by the agency, they needed to decide as a team if they should continue or not. His vote, he said, was to walk away. Manuel agreed with Andrew's vote and looked towards Cynthia, the account manager. The tension between Manuel and Cynthia was no secret, and everyone in the room knew that Cynthia could probably tell you to the penny what the aggressive pitching process had cost the agency over the past 2 months. Cynthia leaned forward in her chair and said, I saw the way they treated Manuel yesterday. I vote hell no. The rest of the team agreed, and the vote was unanimous. In addition to the financial consequences, Andrew knew that fallout was likely in the advertising community. It's highly unusual to get that far in a pitch process and pull out. But this was a risk that he, the team, and the agency's owners were willing to take. During the call to the client explaining their decision, Andrew did not blame the decision on the poor behavior of the company's branding team, but instead took responsibility for not accurately assessing the fit and timing. Several months later, he received a call from a leader in the company's branding division asking about his team's experience. Andrew had the sense that the brand was trying to understand its growing reputation as a difficult partner. This time, he told her more directly what he thought about the culture clash and the behaviors he found to be unprofessional. Andrew and his colleagues told me that something changed the day they decided not to pursue the pitch. Andrew attributed it to Manuel and Cynthia coming together to protect the team. His colleagues agreed about the power of that moment, but they also said that Andrew's willingness to own his mistake and apologize shifted something in the spirit of the place. The one thing they could say emphatically was that the levels of trust, respect, and pride within the team skyrocketed after that experience. Andrew said, "We worked together, we fell together, we climbed up together." That changes people. The reckoning. Andrew's face down in the arena moment was very clear to him. It came with the pain and guilt he felt over not intervening as he watched his talented team being treated with disrespect while they were presenting work that was important to them. His curiosity was less about, what is this feeling? And more about, what am I going to do now? The rumble. Andrew laughed when he told me that he thinks he has the shortest SFD in history. A single three-word sentence. I'm a screw-up. When I asked him what the rumble had been like to let him get from I'm a screw-up to I screwed up, he said, I had to take on shame, blame, fear, perfectionism, accountability, trust, and failure for sure. I can give other people a break, but I'm hard on myself. Self-trust was a big part of it for me. Rumbling with shame and perfectionism. The difference between shame and guilt lies in the way we talk to ourselves. Shame is a focus on self, while guilt is a focus on behavior. This is not just semantics. There's a huge difference between I screwed up, which is guilt, and I am a screw up, which is shame. The former is acceptance of our imperfect humanity. The latter is basically an indictment of our very existence. It's always helpful to remember that when perfectionism is driving, shame is riding shotgun. Perfectionism is not healthy striving. It's not asking, how can I be my best self? Instead, it's asking, what will people think? When looking at our own stories, we can benefit from wondering, did something happen in this story that left me feeling like my cover was blown, revealing that I'm really not what I want people to think I am? Did my pretend, please, perfect, perform, prove, house of cards come tumbling down? For those of us who struggle with perfectionism, it's not difficult to find ourselves in situations similar to Andrew's, ones where we look back and think, I got sucked in to proving I could, rather than stepping back and asking if I should, or if I really even wanted to. Another one of shame's sidekicks is comparison. I have a picture over my desk of the pool where I swim that reminds me to keep comparison in check. Under the picture I wrote, stay in your own lane. Comparison kills creativity and joy. For me, swimming is the trifecta of health: meditation, therapy, and exercise. But only when I stay in my own lane, focused on my breathing and my stroke. Problems begin when I happen to sync up with the swimmer next to me and we push off the wall at the same time, because I always start comparing and competing. A couple of months ago, I did it to the point where I almost re-injured my rotator cuff. Believe me, comparison sucks the creativity and joy right out of life. If our story includes shame, perfectionism, or comparison, and we're left feeling isolated or less than, we need to employ two completely counterintuitive strategies. We need to first talk to ourselves in the same way we talk to someone we love. Yes, you made a mistake. You're human. You don't have to do it like anyone else does. Fixing it and making amends will help. Self-loathing will not. And the second thing is to reach out to someone we trust, a person who has earned the right to hear our story and who has the capacity to respond with empathy. The second strategy is especially effective because shame can't survive being spoken. It thrives on secrecy, silence, and judgment. If we can share our experience of shame with someone who responds with empathy, shame can't survive. We share our stories, even our shitty first drafts, to get clear on what we're feeling and what triggered those feelings, allowing us to build a deeper, more meaningful connection with both ourselves and our trusted friends. Andrew reached out to a friend, shared his struggle, got an empathic response, and was encouraged to give himself the same grace he so willingly offered others. There are a million ways this story could have gone bad, and only one way to turn it around. Address the shame. Rumbling with blame and accountability. In research terms, we think about blame as a form of anger used to discharge discomfort or pain. The shame-blame combo is so common because we're desperate to get out from underneath the pain of shame, and we see blame as a quick fix. If, for example, I suddenly realized that I missed an important conference call earlier, sometimes in a split second, I'm discharging that frustration by yelling at my child or my student or my employee. I always say, when we're in shame, we're not fit for human consumption, and we're especially dangerous around people over whom we have some power. It doesn't have to be something big. Blame works to discharge mild discomfort too. You're late for work and you can't find that shirt you want to wear, so you yell at your partner for hanging the dry cleaning in the wrong place in the closet. It doesn't have to make sense either. It just has to give us some sense of relief and control. In fact, for most of us who rely on blaming and finding fault, the need for control is so strong that we'd rather have something be our fault than succumb to the bumper sticker wisdom of shit happens. If stuff just happens, how do I control that? Fault finding fools us into believing that someone is always to blame. Hence, controlling the outcome is possible. But blame is as corrosive as it is unproductive. I always know that I need to rumble with blame when there's a kid self in my SFD waving her arms wildly and saying with righteous fury, it's all their fault. Or if I'm looking for the person, unfairness, or annoyance that tripped me up and landed me face down. In Andrew's case, one of the first thoughts that came to mind when he was hustling under that rock was, who's to blame? I imagine most of us have had the experience of trying to blame and hustle our way out of the pain of I'm a screw-up. The difference between accountability and blame is very similar to the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt gets a bad rap, but the emotional discomfort of guilt can be a powerful and healthy motivator for change. Of course, feeling guilty about something over which we have no control, or something that isn't our responsibility, is not helpful. And more times than not, what we think is guilt is really shame and the fear of not being enough. Like guilt, accountability is often motivated by wanting to live in alignment with our values. Accountability is holding ourselves or someone else responsible for specific actions and their specific consequences. Blame, on the other hand, is simply a quick, broad-brush way to offload anger, fear, shame, or discomfort. We think we'll feel better after pointing a finger at someone or something, but nothing changes. Instead, blame kills relationships and organizational cultures. It's toxic. It's also a go-to reaction for many of us. Accountability is a prerequisite for strong relationships and cultures. It requires authenticity, action, and the courage to apologize and make amends. Rumbling with accountability is a hard and time-consuming process. It also requires vulnerability. We have to own our feelings and reconcile our behaviors and choices with our values. Andrew demonstrated both vulnerability and courage when he stood in front of his team and said, "I screwed up, and I'm sorry." Rumbling with trust. Trust in ourselves and in others is often the first casualty in a fall, and stories of shattered trust can render us speechless with hurt or send us into a defensive silence. Maybe someone betrayed us or let us down, or our own judgment led us astray. How could I have been so stupid and naive? Did I miss the warning signs? If I've learned anything in my research, it's that trust can't be hotwired. Whether it's between two friends or within a work team, it's grown in a process that takes place over the course of a relationship. Several of the Daring Way facilitators referred me to Charles Feltman's The Thin Book of Trust. While the book focuses on building trust at work, I found Feltman's definitions of trust and distrust to fit powerfully with my own findings. Feltman describes trust as choosing to risk making something you value vulnerable to another person's actions. And he describes distrust as deciding that what is important to me is not safe with this person in this situation or any situation. When rumbling with our stories about losing trust, we need to be able to identify exactly where the breach lies and to speak to it. As Feltman writes, it isn't surprising people seldom talk directly about distrust. If it requires you to use words like sneaky, mean, or liar to tell someone you don't trust him or her, you're probably going to think twice about it. The ability to point to specific behaviors rather than just using the word trust can also help us rumble with our stories of falling. The more specific we can be, the more likely it is that we can create change. In my research, seven elements of trust emerged as useful in both trusting others and trusting ourselves. I came up with the acronym BRAVING for the elements. It also serves as a checklist when I'm rumbling with trust issues with the people in my life. As Feltman so wisely suggests, breaking down the attributes of trust into specific behaviors allows us to more clearly identify and address breaches of trust. I love the BRAVING checklist because it reminds me that trusting myself or other people is a vulnerable and courageous process. Let's look at the acronym BRAVING. B-R-A-V-I-N-G. B for boundaries. You respect my boundaries, and when you're not clear about what's okay and not okay, you ask. You're willing to say no. R, reliability. You do what you say you'll do. At work, this means staying aware of your competencies and limitations so you don't overpromise and are able to deliver on commitments and balance competing priorities. A, accountability. You own your mistakes, apologize, and make amends. V, vault. You don't share information or experiences that are not yours to share. I need to know that my confidences are kept and that you're not sharing with me any information about other people that should be confidential. I, integrity. You choose courage over comfort. You choose what is right over what is fun, fast, or easy. And you choose to practice your values rather than simply professing them. N, non-judgment. I can ask for what I need, and you can ask for what you need. We can talk about how we feel without judgment. G, generosity. You extend the most generous interpretation possible to the intentions, words, and actions of others. Self-trust is often a casualty of failure. In many of the interviews about professional and personal failure, the research participant would say, "I don't know if I can trust myself again," or "I've lost faith in my own judgment." If you listen to this checklist and change the pronouns, you'll see that BRAVING also works as a powerful tool for assessing our level of self-trust. B, did I respect my own boundaries? Was I clear about what's okay and what's not okay? R, was I reliable? Did I do what I said I was going to do? A, did I hold myself accountable? V, did I respect the vault and share appropriately? I, did I act for my integrity? N, did I ask for what I needed? Was I non-judgmental about needing help? G, was I generous toward myself? If you hold up Andrew's choices and behaviors against any of these elements of trust, you'll see that mistakes don't bankrupt trust in the way that violations of personal accountability, integrity, or values can. Trust and mistakes can coexist, and often do, as long as we make amends, stay aligned with our values, and confront shame and blame head on. Rumbling with failure. Part of the tape that was playing on a loop in Andrew's head was, "I am a failure." Failure is a slippery word because we use it to describe a wide range of experiences, from risky efforts that didn't pan out or ideas that were never launched, to painful life-altering losses. Whatever the experience, failure feels like a lost opportunity, like something that can't be redone or undone. Regardless of the context or magnitude, failure brings with it the sense that we've lost some of our personal power. Many of us have a negative, almost stomach-clenching reaction to the word power. I think this is because we automatically conflate power and power over. But the type of power I'm talking about is more in line with Martin Luther King Jr.'s definition of it. The ability to achieve our purpose and to affect change. Experiencing failure often leads to feeling powerless simply because we didn't achieve our purpose and or affect the change we wanted to see. The connection between failure and powerlessness is important, because all of my years of research lead me to argue that we are the most dangerous to ourselves and to the people around us when we feel powerless. Powerlessness leads to fear and desperation. Look behind an act of violence, from bullying to terrorism, and you will often find a frantic attempt to escape powerlessness. The feelings of powerlessness that often accompany failure start with those all too familiar could have or should have self-inventories. And our fear grows in tandem with the strength of our belief that an opening has been forever closed. Pervasive feelings of powerlessness eventually lead to despair. My favorite definition of despair comes from author and pastor Rob Bell. Rob says, despair is a spiritual condition. It's the belief that tomorrow will be just like today. My heart stopped when I heard him say this. Man, I know what it feels like to be under that rock and to believe with all of my heart that there's no way out and that I'll be in the exact same spot tomorrow. For me, that feeling is absolutely a spiritual crisis. In my work, I've found that moving out of powerlessness and even despair requires hope. Hope is not an emotion. It's a cognitive process, a thought process made up of what researcher C.R. Snyder called the trilogy of goals, pathways, and agency. Hope happens when we can set goals, have the tenacity and perseverance to pursue those goals, and believe in our own abilities to act. Snyder also found that hope is learned. When boundaries, consistency, and support are in place, children learn it from their parents. But even if we didn't get it as kids, we can still learn hope as adults. It's just tougher when we're older because we have to resist and unlearn old habits, like the tendency to give up when things get tough. Hope is a function of struggle. If we're never allowed to fall or face adversity as children, we are denied the opportunity to develop the tenacity and sense of agency we need to be hopeful. One of the greatest gifts my parents gave me was hope. When I fell, failed, or screwed up, they did not run to the rescue. They supported me, but they always expected me to figure it out. They placed high value on grit and moxie, and this has served me well, especially in my career as a writer. I wrote my first book in 2002. The title was Hairy Toes and Sexy Rice, Women, Shame, and the Media. The title was based on two stories from my own life, set 25 years apart. The Hairy Toes part was the story of my first experience with shame and body image. When I was 8 years old, I found a little peach fuzz on my big toe and spent months quietly scouring the pages of Seventeen and Young Miss magazines, trying to figure out if I was normal. Nothing. Any close-ups of models' feet showed toes that were totally bald. Convinced that I was the only girl in the world with hair on her toes, I did the only two things I could think of. I bought more of the things I saw in the magazine ads, like Noxzema and Bonnie Bell lip gloss, and I hid my toes. This is how my love affair with clogs started. Sexy Rice referred to a television commercial popular between 1999 and 2000. Once, after a long day of teaching, I was looking forward to a little alone time before Steve and my then one-year-old daughter got home. Once the bra off, hair up, TV on, ritual was complete, I sank into the couch and was contemplating what to fix for dinner when something on the television caught my eye. A beautiful woman in a silk teddy and a gorgeous beefy guy were panting, groping each other, and sliding down the front of a Sub-Zero refrigerator. Every couple of seconds, the lovers would pause to take turns spoon-feeding each other. Damn, I think that's rice, I thought, Finally, in the very last shot, the camera panned to a bowl of rice and a familiar logo appeared on the screen. I rolled my eyes and thought, that was so stupid. Next, I started thinking, do they really think people actually do that? I bet guys would love that, to come home and have dinner spoon-fed to them as they have sex against the fridge. Then, as the advertising gods intended, I started feeling a little sad about my own mundane dinner plans and the sweats I was wearing and the sandwiches we would probably eat and the half conversations we would have while we played with Ellen and the baby weight I couldn't lose and the inevitability of falling asleep during the news. So I use these experiences to title my first book about the research I was conducting on women and shame. I spent 6 months trying to find an agent, at the end of which all I had to show for my efforts was a huge file of impersonal rejection letters. My last hope was a writer's conference in Austin, where, for the price of a ticket, I could have a 10-minute audience with a real live editor from New York City. I was scared, excited, and hopeful. My 10-minute meeting was with an editor from a house known for publishing serious nonfiction. I immediately liked the look of him. He had disheveled hair, he was wearing chunky, weird glasses, and he seemed a bit tortured. In my mind, those things made him legit. "What do you have for me?" he asked as I sat down. Surprisingly, I wasn't nervous at all as I started to deliver the lines I had rehearsed for days. He propped his chin on his fist and frowned as I told him about my book. "Do you have anything with you?" he asked. I pulled out a proposal complete with a cover letter addressed to him. He grabbed some pages and began reading. After a few minutes, he told me that he thought I had something important and valuable here, but that he hated the title. Then he said, "There's nothing funny about shame. Don't lighten up the subject." Nietzsche said, "What do you consider the most humane? To spare someone shame? What is the seal of liberation? To no longer be ashamed in front of oneself." He looked at me. "Be serious. You have the credentials." I started to tell him that I disagreed, that being serious about shame and recognizing the importance of humor and laughter to healing weren't mutually exclusive, but then my time ran out. He quickly gave me the name and number of an agent. As I walked out of the room, his parting words were, "I really hate the humor. I hate the title. No funny stories. Remember Nietzsche." The door closed behind me. I was under the rock. Rather than trying to crawl out, I took his advice, changed the title to Women in Shame, and got rid of some of my funny stories. I couldn't bear to strip all of the laughter out of the book, but looking back, I know now I took way more out than I should have, and I wasn't being true to myself. His agent friend turned down my proposal, and over the next year I sent 40 more query letters to agents and publishers. All I got in return were form letters that said some version of, "As titillating as a book about shame written by an academic sounds, we're not interested." So I borrowed money from my parents, and in 2004, I self-published Women in Shame. Self-publishing was relatively new back then, and it was expensive and clunky. I had to store the books myself, and Steve and I did most of the shipping with the help of my friend Charles. I even sold books out of my trunk at events. One day, a faculty colleague stopped me in the elevator and said, "I read your book. It's really powerful. I'm going to order it and add it to my syllabus. Who's your publisher?" I stalled for a minute. Then I said, "I published it myself." He stepped out of the elevator and, as he held the door open with his hand, turned back to me and said, "I really can't add a vanity published book to my syllabus." I couldn't breathe. The weight of that rock literally took my breath away. I immediately pictured myself hawking my book on the corner, wearing one of those coin changer belts. I was so full of shame that at one very low point, when a woman pulled out her checkbook and asked to whom she should write her check, I actually said, "Make it out to the publisher," as I held up the book and pretended to read the name of the publisher off the spine, as if it wasn't me. 6 months later, though, the book caught on with mental health professionals and began selling like hotcakes. I even convinced a large distributor to help me get it into a few Barnes & Noble stores. Then, on one very magical evening, I met one of my great heroes, the psychologist and author Harriet Lerner. One thing led to the next, and within 3 months, I had an agent and a book deal for Women in Shame. I couldn't believe it. The reworked book was titled I Thought It Was Just Me, and it came out in February of 2007. Steve and I were psyched, and our parents were ready to hold down the fort and help with the kids while I traveled to media outlets and did the book tour. I maxed out one of our credit cards buying new clothes. I practiced my Today Show interview every morning in the mirror. It was go time. Go, go, go. Now. It's go time. Nothing. The phone rang once on publication day. It was the bank informing us that we had overlooked a student loan payment and owed a late fee. I was devastated. The phone didn't ring the next day or the next. And there I sat with my closet full of new outfits and a post-it note that I had named Katie Couric stuck on my bathroom mirror. In a moment of desperation, I scrambled to put together a book reading in Chicago, where I was already doing a lecture for mental health professionals. It was the coldest February day on record. 5 people came to the reading. 1 woman was drunk, and 2 of them were there because they thought I was a mystery writer. 6 months after the book came out, I got a call from the publisher asking if I wanted to buy copies at a great low price. At first I was excited, but then I learned that they were offering me the opportunity to buy hundreds of books. This isn't a good thing, Brené, the publisher said. Your book is being remaindered. The sales are too low to keep it in our warehouse. That's valuable real estate, and if we're not moving books, they have to go. I don't understand, I replied. What does remaindered even mean? I sat on the floor in my kitchen and listened to him explain the process of moving books from the warehouses to the bargain bins. Any leftover books were sent to the pulping machines. I'm being composted, I thought. It was a devastating failure for me. 5 years of work gone in 6 months. I felt it all, the powerlessness and the despair and the shame. After I spent 3 weeks in shame-fueled blaming of others and berating myself for everything I should and could have done, Steve helped me out from under the rock. As I would learn, the hardest part of coming out from hiding is facing the painful work of rumbling with the real story. And the real story was that I had set myself up for failure. I swore that if I ever had the opportunity to publish a book again, I'd do it differently. I wasn't going to get dressed up in my new outfit and wait for someone to knock on my door and ask me about my work. I would put on my shit kickers and start knocking on doors myself. I've published 4 books now, and I still feel scared and exposed and vulnerable as I prepare to share a new idea with the world. I still flinch a little when I turn to my community and say, I'm trying this and I'd love your support. But I try to remind myself that, on the flip side, I love it when someone is genuinely excited about his or her work. I've also learned in all of my rumbles that if you don't put value on your work, no one is going to do that for you. I've rumbled with failure and shame enough over the past decade to know this. You can do everything right. You can cheer yourself on, have all the support you can find in place, and be 100% ready to go, and still fail. It happens to writers, artists, entrepreneurs, health professionals, teachers, you name it. But if you can look back during your rumble and see that you didn't hold back, that you were all in, you will feel very different than someone who didn't fully show up. You may have to deal with failure, but you won't have to wrestle with the same level of shame that we experience when our efforts were half-hearted. And in addition to assessing the level of our effort, our experience of failure is also shaped by how well we lived out our values. Were we all in, and were we true to ourselves? When you're rumbling with failure and it's clear that the choices you made along the way were not in alignment with your values, you have to grapple not only with the fallout of failing, but also with the feeling that you betrayed yourself. Andrew had to reconcile his decision to push down his concerns and uneasiness about the new project and his choice to stay quiet during the meeting with what he believed in his heart. I had to rumble with the consequences of silencing my instincts on the best ways to approach the topic of shame and to successfully get a book out into the world. I knew the most effective way for me, maybe not everyone, but certainly for me, to talk about shame was to use everyday stories, even a few funny or absurd ones like Sexy Rice, to illustrate how we fall prey to ridiculous and unattainable messages about perfection. But I took that Nietzsche advice and ran it through my not good enough processor until it morphed into grow up, Brené, be serious, and stop clowning around. I also knew how to sell books, coin changer belt and all. Sadly, as a new academic, I ran the vanity publishing comment through the same gremlin processor and redefined a proper and sophisticated author as one who distanced herself from the unsavory ordeal of promoting and selling the book. When I look back at these two experiences today, I know that both were potential face-down-in-the-arena moments, ones that if they happened today, I hope would lead me to acknowledge my self-doubt and shame. I hope today I'd think, wow, I'm grateful for the advice from the editor, but it doesn't mean I need to accept it without question. Or, damn, that vanity publishing comment was hurtful and probably meant to be shaming, but his view of my efforts doesn't need to dictate how I see myself. But I didn't have the information or experience that I have today. So rather than getting curious about the hurt I was feeling, I silenced my pain by codifying the expert advice. Choosing to place greater value on what the experts thought than on what I was feeling or what I knew about my own work made the composting conversation, which was ultimately my face-down moment, far more painful. In both instances, I walked away from the two values that guide my life, my faith and my commitment to be brave. My faith calls me to practice love over fear. And in this experience, I let fear trample all over self-love. I made every decision with the mindset, what will people think, rather than I am enough. That is as unholy as it gets for me. Courage calls for me to show up and be seen. And in this instance, I literally hid at home and waited for someone else to show up and do the work, including the publisher and the book-buying public. Of all the things I regret from this experience, the biggest one is betraying my own values and being so unkind to myself. But as you'll see in the next section, I'm a student of regret. And she's a tough but fair teacher whose lessons on empathy and compassion are critical pieces of wholehearted living. Rumbling with regret. If there's one thing that failure has taught me, it is the value of regret. Regret is one of the most powerful emotional reminders that change and growth are necessary. In fact, I've come to believe that regret is kind of a package deal. It's a function.